All right, y'all. Enough stalling for time. I should be talking. Welcome to the show. How are you guys doing? Big show today. Well, you know, same as always. Huge. I'm joining up the chat room right now. That's why I'm talking like this. So I'm doing something else while I'm talking. Join up the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. Also, follow me on Twitter. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Or like me on Facebook. Facebook.com/ScottHortonShow. Or subscribe to me on YouTube. YouTube.com/ScottHortonShow. Oh, wait. I got a burp from this Dr. Pepper here. Listen to the BCs for a second. That's called radio professionalism right there, see? I muted my microphone for you. I know, if I was a real professional, I wouldn't drink a bunch of Dr. Pepper right before I went on the air. But I'm not, so I did. I do. I shall. Yeah. All right, anyway, so Mitchell Prothero is going to be on the show. He's a reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. I think right now he's in Lebanon, but he's been spending some time in Syria as well, reporting there on the various al-Qaeda's America's supporting and opposing. I don't know if they're really opposing any. I don't know how much they're really supporting this one or that one, but Mitchell Prothero is going to be on the show today to help and set us straight for that. So that's good. I've been meaning to interview him for a while. Well, I finally got around to getting it done, so there you go. Also, Doug Casey is going to be on the show. And, yeah, we're going to talk about some things like debt. Only, don't worry, we're going to make it really fun and exciting. It'll be about the collapse of the American Empire forever. I think. That's usually what Doug Casey seems to like to talk about. All right. And Marcy Wheeler, the smartest brain in the blogosphere. She's an expert on everything that she takes an interest in. And so this year, for this past, you know, half a year, that's meant, well, and longer than that, that's meant the NSA and all the various scandals. But she's been especially good since all the Snowden documents came out. And of course, this morning, the president gave his big speech about his proposed reforms. And I admit I didn't get through the whole thing, but Marcy has written up her empty wheel annotated version of the president's speech for everyone to look at. That's at emptywheel.net. I took a few notes of my own. So we got 702s and 215s and 12333s and different lies and obfuscations and questions that I have about how much the national government is going to be sharing, the military, frankly, the National Security Agency is the military, how much information they're going to be sharing in the future with the state and local police. I think he, and the other federal civilian police agencies, I think the president said something about, oh yeah, we're going to make sure that that doesn't happen, but what that means to me is, yeah, they're going to codify just how it shall happen, and then they're going to do it more. And that's where the totalitarianism is. You know, yes, it's true that were they to go back and look at your file and pull together all of your metadata, they sure would know everything about you. But when they, when the National Security Agency can just turn over their catch to any interested law enforcement agency to see if they can find anything to enforce against you based on everything about you. Yeah, well, see you in the prison camp. All of us. It'll be like the West Bank. They'll just have to build giant concrete walls throughout America and turn all of America into a giant concentration camp. Because everybody's guilty of something. Certainly according to the Democrats and the Republicans. It's funny, you know. I saw on TV somebody had to say this morning that, hey, listen, what if Richard Nixon had this technical capability? Just think of it. And, you know, really, according to these people, you got to understand the mindset of the people that close to power in mass media and in Washington, D.C. and whatever. He's the last dangerous president they can think of. He's certainly the last one who, you know, is a certifiable villain. He had to resign in disgrace and leave office because or else the Senate was going to remove him. So he's officially a big, bad loser. He's the aberration. He's that one time the American people accidentally made somebody president when they really shouldn't have because he was really a bad guy. He's the only time that ever happened, according to the official story. But okay, so fine. We'll settle for that. What if the Americans accidentally elected another Nixonian type who let the power, you know, get to his head a little bit, starting using this power against his enemies a little bit? We have no other examples of that happening. But then just think, you know, and this is like it's like a science fiction movie, but it's one of those like very near future things where you can barely tell that it's the future. The cars are just one or two model years ahead. Where the NSA has sufficiently networked all the databases and they can push and pull. The better way to say it would be not just pull, they can push whatever they want out. And it's all in the Israeli written software, right? Where they can just decide where anything that the computer thinks might be a violation of a regulation or an offense against the state somewhere automatically gets distributed out through the network to the local or state or federal civilian police body charged with enforcing that. So in other words, the traffic camera on the freeway tied directly to the IRS. There he goes. Get him. There he is. That guy that owes us money, we say. Everyone for everything all the time. Hey, you're driving around in circles in this neighborhood kind of suspiciously, the computer noticed. So what do you have to say for yourself? Little Miss Guilty Until Proven Innocent. Oh, you took a wrong turn, did you? That's basically what would happen if you had the technology that they have, but with all bets off, all old laws restricting their ability to do those kinds of things null. And of course, you could just have, as Tommy Franks, the general who invaded Iraq, so, you know, he's willing to follow through on his threats, that guy, Tommy Frank said, hey, if we had one more September 11th sized attack in America, that level of an emergency, we would have a military form of government from then on. That's it. And then it would just be a matter of, right, the NSA, the DIA, Navy Intelligence, working with whatever other agencies they, declare belong to them now. And then they could have ultimate enforcement. It's turnkey totalitarianism. Those are the words of Frank Church, the guy that the senator from Idaho, who was the chairman of the committee who investigated all of Nixon's abuses and other abuses onto the CIA and the NSA and the FBI back in the 1970s. He said, what we've created here to use against the Soviet Union to protect ourselves from the Soviets could be used to turn America into a turnkey totalitarian state. So anyway, it seems to me like this is a very short window of opportunity, probably. It certainly is a window of opportunity. I don't know how short. For the American people to really, you know, kind of get our act together and decide whether we want the Bill of Rights or don't we. Because we might not have another chance like this to fight back about this. The lawless surveillance state. See? Tell him, Chuck.
Hey, Al Scott here.
Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all. It's the Scott Horton Show. Stop by scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. And like I say, coming up on the show, Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy on Syria, Doug Casey on the empire in general and whatever the hell he wants to talk about, I think, and Marcy Wheeler on the NSA. And now I got a bunch of other news I want to go ahead and try to get to for you here. First of all, you know, I hate to quote this guy. I wouldn't want anybody to, you know, well, I don't really care. You can take it out of context if you want to take it out of context, but, you know, don't. But I got to quote Khalid Sheikh Mohammed for you. Now, his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, is the guy that built the bomb for the first World Trade Center bombing back in 1993, and who wrote a letter to the New York Times explaining why it was that he did it. It was revenge for Palestine. Called himself the Liberation Army, whatever. And that was the blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman and his buddies in the Egyptian Islamic Jihad and kind of proto-Al-Qaeda. And bin Laden actually helped pay the legal bills for some of those guys who were part of the later plot that was thwarted to attack the UN and the Holland Tunnel and the Lincoln Tunnel. And anyway, so yeah, it was about Palestine. Always was about Palestine. Bin Laden wrote his big thing back in 1996, again in 1998, said it was all about Palestine. As well as, of course, the bases in Saudi Arabia from which the blockade in Iraq was waged. The blockade against Iraq was waged throughout the 90s. And then, of course, I'm always quoting for you from, oh man, come on, Terry McDermott's book, Perfect Soldiers, about how the Hamburg cell, this is according to the people who knew these guys best in real life, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and Mohammed Atta and their friends who lived in Hamburg and were radicalized at the mosque and went off to Afghanistan together and joined up the plot and became the ringleader hijackers of the September 11th plot. They would sit around all day watching the foreign news about what was going on in Hamburg, Germany, watching the news about what was going on in Lebanon and in Palestine and saying that the Americans had to pay for this. That was their motivation. Like I was telling you the other day, Mohammed Atta actually did this, you know, symbolic thing, which it sounds horrible and evil or corny and stupid or whatever when it's the other side, right? But you could totally see an American doing something like this, filling out his last will and testament. Those guys knocked our towers down. It's time to go teach him a lesson. And in case I die over there, here's my will. Well, that's what he did. The Americans killed a bunch of women and children, or the Israelis with American weapons and American money and American permission killed a bunch of women and children at Qana. And so here's my last will and testament. I'm joining up the war as a soldier on that side. That's just the true history of it. I'm not taking his side. I'm from here. I'm just telling you, that's who these guys are. That's what they hate. American support for the Israelis, and not just the Israelis' existence. Not because everybody who's not an Israeli is born a Nazi wants to kill all Israelis. It's because of Israeli policy, cruel, horrible policies like the occupation of Palestine and the occupation of Lebanon that went on for so many years. And that's just the fact. And so now, Ryan Grimm at the Huffington Post is quoting Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was Ramzi Youssef's uncle and the main ringleader of the 9/11 attack for Osama bin Laden. And what he says is that, well, oh yeah, he wants to convert everybody and now he renounces violence and whatever. So, look, the guy's a murderer. I'm not saying anyone should take his word for anything, right? I'm just saying this is what he's saying. He seeks to clarify one particular critique of al-Qaeda. He and the organization do not hate American freedoms, he says. Quote Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, according to these papers obtained by the Huffington Post, do not believe those who claim the Mujahideen fights infidels to turn them to Islam or that we are fighting you because you practice democracy, freedom, or claim that you uphold human rights, he says. Instead, repeating the al-Qaeda narrative of a jihad or cosmic war, cosmic? Against America, defensive war against America in retaliation for attacking and oppressing Muslims and supporting Israel. He singles out the media and the intelligence services as responsible for misleading the public, claiming they hide from them, that's us, you and me, why the Mujahideen carried out 9/11 and what is the truth about the war on terror. And so, there you go. They were lying back when they ever said that. That they hate you, that they hate America, that they hate the American government because of what's good about us. It was never that. Any more than they hate what's good about Israel. What they hate is support for their dictators, support for brutal military occupations, support for mass murder from the air, and strangulation blockades by the UN Security Council that starve and murder 500,000 people or more in Iraq in the 1990s. That was what they said. So, now that doesn't mean that, oh, so they're good and we should surrender to them and do whatever they say or anything like that, but it means that, geez, wouldn't it be nice if they actually, if our government and media ever discussed this war in real terms? What it is that the enemy is fighting for. You know, Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, recently jumped the shark and got in terrible trouble calling for the assassination of the president, which is pretty stupid. In fact, in context, if you read the thing, it was just retarded for him to say that. But he was questioned by, because I think he teaches at Georgetown. So the Georgetown University newspaper asked him, man, you want to stand by that? And he said, yeah, I do want to stand by that. And his rant was that basically our government are traitors to us, the American people, because they still keep lying to us and saying that the enemy hates us because of how good we are. So therefore, we have no choice but to stay good and keep killing them, is the conclusion. And he's saying it's not true. They hate us for what we do. And by the way, it's a bunch of things that are you sure you want to do? Like support the kings of Arabia no matter what. Support the torture military dictatorship in Egypt. Support the endless killing of Iraqis like it's the new sport of the 21st century. Or maybe we don't have to do this. Maybe we don't have to fight them in Iraq while we back them in Syria and Libya. While we fight them in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And fight them but make them much more powerful in Yemen and in Somalia. It's crazy. And so there's the truth about it. And it doesn't matter whether, again, I'm telling you that this guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is a mass murderer. You're not. I'm not asking you to believe that he believes a word that he says. I'm just telling you this is what he says, and this is how he gets other people to listen to him on his side. This is his Army of One commercial. He says, he doesn't tell people, hey, join up and be a suicide bomber because Americans let their daughters go to community college. He's saying join up and be a suicide bomber because of who they are killing in their lands. As Ron Paul put it in 2007, they're over here because we're over there first. First. Doesn't make them the good guys, right? Just because the evil empire is the evil empire doesn't mean everyone who opposes them is Luke Skywalker. They could just as easily be Jabba the Hutt and not like the Empire and still be bad guys and still be mass murderers of civilians as these lunatics have proven themselves to be time and time again since 1993. Doesn't make them good, but does mean that this is what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is telling people, told people back then to get them to join up his fight against us. So anyway, that's the story of the war on terrorism. And, you know, here we are still. It's 2014. You know, I read a thing at Foreign Policy the other day. You might have heard where Jake Tapper got into a fight over whether he accidentally said that the lives in Afghanistan were lost, our lives, American lives only count, were lost for nothing or not. And, you know, this guy, he's a guy who was embedded for a year with a group of guys out there and did a whole book about it, a real piece of journalism on it, whatever. And so he totally was backpedaling and saying he's so sorry. You know, he didn't mean it that way and whatever. And then somebody wrote a Foreign Policy that, like, you know what, man? The truth, and this is in Thomas Ricks's blog. Thomas Ricks, who left the Washington Post to be the official spokesperson for the empire, basically, for David Petraeus and the surge in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's on Tom Ricks's blog, and I'm not familiar with the guy who wrote it. But anyway, it's, you know, official enough inside the halls of power. You know, inside the goalposts of acceptable opinion. And what he wrote was, hey, we need to face up to the fact that this is completely the wrong idea to occupy Afghanistan, to invade Iraq, to surge here and surge there and double down. And we haven't won anything. We haven't done anything except install horrible people in power in Afghanistan who are sure to end up losing out anyway once we finally leave and whatever. And, you know, I'm reading this thing and I'm going, you know what? Okay, fine. Like, I appreciate for what it is that here's, you know, kind of militarist insider at foreignpolicy.com writing to other insider types and saying, guys, man, can we please finally knock off the sloganeering for a minute and just accept the fact that, yeah, it's true. The guys in the movie that you love who all died in it, they were on a fool's errand. And maybe they were heroes fighting for each other like a band of brothers and all that. But that's beside the point. That has nothing to do with the question. The question is, who sent them there and to accomplish what goal? And was it ever even possible? And the thing that I kept thinking, and I'm sorry because I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. That's not the point of this. But the thing that I kept thinking while I was reading that was, you know, there were people who told you so all along. It doesn't seem right that every time a horrible warmonger who has done nothing but get us into this mess gets to say, oh, you know what? Turns out this wasn't the right thing, and completely ignore the fact that since 2001, there have been Americans saying peace is the proper response to this, including in New York City, where the first anti-war protests were held. That all of this has been wrong. In fact, a lot of nobodies knew better all along, too. That's just a fact, people in your neighborhood. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Mitchell Prothero, covering the Syria war for McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. Welcome to the show, Mitchell. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me tonight.
I really appreciate you joining us. And I guess you're in Beirut, and it's right around dinner time there, so I especially appreciate you taking time out to do the show today.
No, no problem. It's turned into kind of a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day job covering Lebanon and Syria these days, so we're ready for it.
Right. Well, let's hope nothing newsworthy happens during the interview. All right. In fact, so let's start with that. There have been bombings in Libya, and the war in Syria is spreading to Libya. Is that right? Who's bombing who, and what's been the responses so far?
Well, for a little bit of history, I mean, the country of Lebanon's only existed for about 50 years. And prior to that, it had always historically been part of what they call Greater Syria, which today is mostly the country of Syria. So the ties between these two countries are incredibly close. Syria occupied Lebanon for nearly 28 years, I think, maybe 27, only leaving in 2005 did their military go. So what we've been seeing is a lot of the problems that Lebanon has historically had between religious communities, in this case Sunni and Shia Muslims, it's spread here from Syria as their civil war has grown increasingly sectarian. You've got a country of about 80% Sunni Muslims who've had it with the regime that's backed by Iran and a religious minority there that's very close to them. So it's turning into a difficult situation here.
And now, one of the recent attacks was by one of the other al-Qaeda groups, and I guess we'll have to get into that, but it was against Hezbollah there in southern Lebanon, or in a Hezbollah-controlled neighborhood in Beirut, is that right?
Well, we've had a number of these situations, and what we're finding is, despite Hezbollah's reputation in the United States for being a terrorist organization going back to the 80s, and certainly they've been responsible for attacks against the United States and Israel for decades, although I will point out they haven't done anything towards the United States since the 80s when U.S. troops were here in Lebanon. Hezbollah, being Shia Muslims, are fundamentally representing a group of people who are deeply oppressed by anybody with sort of a Sunni Muslim, what we call Al-Qaeda mentality, the jihadi Salafists. They believe that anybody who isn't a Muslim in the exact traditional way like they are is in fact worse than an infidel and needs to be killed. So what you face is a community here that's fought against the West and Israel for 30-something years, coming under attack by fellow Arabs, fellow Muslims, who believe that their version of Islam is literally apostate. So as they've defended the Syrian regime to try to keep these guys out of here, Hezbollah and Syria, the Syrian president, are very close allies, have been for a long time. They've sent troops to help keep him in power. You're seeing these groups, which are also fighting the regime in Damascus, attacking guys here in Lebanon. So Hezbollah is in a very similar situation to America or Israel, where they have Muslim terrorists trying to set off car bombs in their areas. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I guess Hezbollah has done some operations inside Syria on behalf of the government, and then are these bombings, you think, meant to draw them in further and try to spread this war around, or maybe erase that European-drawn border there?
Well, here, in a way, quite the opposite. First off, the al-Qaeda guys, in their mentality, this is all part of a historic area. So fundamentally to them, they don't recognize the government of Lebanon, and they don't recognize the government of Syria. They'd only recognize an Islamic caliphate. So they don't care, you know, in terms of ideology, where they're going to attack Hezbollah. But Hezbollah, yes, it's not even doing operations. For the first time in the organization's 30-plus year history, they're openly engaging in a military conflict against fellow Arabs, and doing it more or less more openly than I've ever seen them do anything in the 10 years I've lived in Lebanon. They're defending it politically. They've got, you know, anywhere from hundreds to thousands of troops inside Syria. And many of us think that it's been the role of Hezbollah's very experienced, very professional fighters that has probably kept the Assad regime alive. So if you're fighting the Assad regime, starting trouble in Lebanon might draw some of those guys back home for security, and thus reduce the number of people you're facing on the battlefield in Syria. I think that's the mentality that we're looking at. Mm-hmm.
All right. And now, so when we talk about the Nusra Front and the Islamic Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham and all of these things, who's who, and how can you tell a different al-Qaeda from one from another?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had a discussion with my editor about this the other day, where he said, you know, ideologically, most of these groups are al-Qaeda and probably aren't going to be very friendly to the West. And I told him he was absolutely right. The problem is they see fundamental differences amongst themselves. And in the case of most of the Syrian groups, they're currently fighting a predominantly foreign group of what we would call al-Qaeda fighters previously. But today we can't even call them that, because al-Qaeda has said, these guys are psychos. We don't want anything to do with them, which is something that I reported about today from McClatchy. There's actually a letter from a member of Al-Qaeda who's fighting in Syria where he said, you know, you're not Al-Qaeda, I'm Al-Qaeda. I knew bin Laden. You people are crazy. Mm-hmm. Your crimes are against Muslims and all this stuff.
Well, now
so what you're looking at is a group called... So the main group that you're looking at in this case is what they call the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, or ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. These guys were formed by veterans fighting against the United States during the occupation of Iraq. They're filled with foreign fighters, and they had come into Iraq, or come into Syria, to support the rebellion initially, but what they started doing was setting up their own Islamic State. And most of them are foreign, so even if you're a very conservative Syrian, like you might see in groups like the Nusra Front, Ahrar al-Sham, the Islamic Front, and these groups have a lot of ideological basis with al-Qaeda, they saw foreigners coming in and pushing a new version of Islam on them, and as a result, they're all fighting.
Right, and so now, back in October, it was ISIS and Nusra were both declaring loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, hiding in somebody's mother's basement in Pakistan, somewhere, I guess, still.
Right.
But then they had a fight over who was more loyal to him or who was in the chain of command. Is that where this real split took place between the Nusra and the ISIS?
It's been actually more local politics. I had a Nusra commander tell me flat out, look, fundamentally, we do agree with these guys. It's just this is about politics, and politics is just as important in jihad as fighting is. That was his explanation. But what you saw was a predominantly Syrian group, that you know, the Nusra Front, that was very effective and continues to be on the battlefield, has done some suicide attacks, but has also been very careful not to irritate Syrian people. When they come in, they do anti-corruption measures. They're not implementing a difficult version of Islamic law in their areas for the most part. Mm-hmm. They're treating people with respect and fighting very hard against the regime. On the other hand, you had this group, ISIS, which were predominantly foreign and were trying to force sort of an alien version of Islam on the Syrian people. As a result, Al-Qaeda actually got involved trying to, you know, negotiate a settlement between these two groups, both of which agree with them. And what they concluded was that Nusra is the proper al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. Everybody in ISIS should join it or leave. And they rejected that advice. So it's the first time in, you know, the 10 years I've been covering this stuff that we've seen a dispute between these groups break out into public.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a lot like what happened in Iraq, right, where the al-Qaeda guys were going around conscripting fighting-age males and punishing people in different ways for smoking cigarettes and vices and these kinds of things, where, like you're saying, they're not even from there, and they wore out their welcome real quick, and that's happening here. But then, so what's the relative power between ISIS and Nusra? Because even though Nusra's from there, one of your articles here is about ISIS fighting back and executing scores of rivals and making some pretty severe gains against Nusra recently.
Well, what it is it's sort of a way that Syria is laid out. And remember, Nusra is not alone. They've got, you know, groups that you'd consider more moderate Islamic groups or even secular called the Syrian Revolutionary Front, which are remnants of the Free Syrian Army that the West had backed. Members of Ahrar al-Sham, who are deeply conservative, but have said that they do not want anything to do with this jihad stuff. They're simply here to fight the regime. And then Nusra. So ISIS is really quite overwhelmed in terms of numbers. But what you're seeing them able to do, because they basically have a lot of experience moving around in the desert between Iraq and Syria. This is where they were formed. You can actually see on a map a corridor between Fallujah and the town of Raqqa. This is all ISIS's turf. It's very empty, and they've come equipped with a lot of, I know this is going to sound funny, but the sheer number of pickup trucks that they have means that they can move around the fighters that they do have relatively quickly. So they've been able to hold their desert areas, but for the most part, they're getting kicked out of the rest of rebel-held Syria in the north and in the west.
Mm. All right, and now, so where exactly did this Islamic Front come from? How large is that? Is that just a new name for the FSA, or that's something altogether that's... No,
quite the opposite, actually. Well, the FSA had basically collapsed in and on itself for a lot of different reasons. The West didn't back them. They sort of lacked popular support, except in the very beginning. but a lot of them had turned to banditry. They were robbing people and sort of acting like a mafia, or they weren't just fighting very hard. So they sort of collapsed. What you saw then as they fell apart were groups that were religiously motivated as the conflict became more Sunni versus Shia. And these groups that hadn't been part of Nusra or ISIS, they're not al-Qaeda by any means, but they are deeply religious guys. I'd compare them to American fundamentalist Christians. They're deeply religious. They get money from outside the country, from mosques and collections. And, they're farm boys to a large extent. And these guys have formed their units, all decided that the rebels needed to be under one command, and all agreed to form what we're calling now the Islamic Front. Mm-hmm. So, there's four main groups. The Islamic Front, which is quite large, probably the largest single fighting force in the country right now. The remnants of the Free Syrian Army, and then Nusra and what we're calling ISIS.
Mm-hmm. And then the Saudis are sending most of their money toward the new Islamic Front, is that right?
Well, we're having a hard time telling exactly what the Saudis are doing. There's a lot of internal politics with the Americans over Iraq. So, and also Saudi, a lot of their money comes from unofficial sources. The mosques collect a tremendous amount of money throughout the Persian Gulf. You see it in Kuwait, Qatar, UAE, and KSA, as we call Saudi Arabia. So, some of it is going to whatever groups they've been funding for a while. But yes, of course, the Saudis, just like the Qataris and UAE, all of them are Kuwaitis, are going to generally back a pretty austere fundamentalist group because that's how their countries are run. So their money has gone to things like the Islamic Front, Ahrar al-Sham, and Nusra to a large extent.
All right. Now, can you hold through this break and do another segment with us here, Mitchell?
Sure, I can do one more.
Okay, great. Everybody, it's Mitchell Prothero writing for McClatchyDC.com, McClatchy Newspapers. He's in Beirut, and we're talking about the civil war in Syria and spreading Iraq and Lebanon and on. We'll be right back after this. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Mitchell Prothero, covering the Syrian war for McClatchy Newspapers at McClatchyDC.com. And we're talking about who's who. Sure is hard to keep track. That thing going on over there.
I spend all day on it, and it's not easy.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I bet. I know. I can tell by reading all the guys, talking with Patrick Coburn and the best experts in the world. They go, well, the lines between who's who and who claims what, it's pretty hard to tell sometimes. But I guess Patrick emphasizes the bloodthirst on the part of these jihadists for killing Shiites indiscriminately. That's all. They just wake up in the morning wanting to kill Shiites, apparently, without even much thought to strategy or anything else.
Well, I don't know that they don't use strategy for it, but yeah, a true fundamentalist Sunni has a very serious, serious problem with Shia Islam. And it's over very small stuff that, not even non-expert, somebody outside of the community could barely tell the difference between the two. But again, it's about a fight 1,500 years ago for control of the direction of the religion. And, right. Certainly both sides haven't quite let it go yet.
Well, so which of the jihadists are the moderates that we can work with? Can we get this Islamic Front to show up in Geneva and negotiate?
Well, ask yourself, if you're the Islamic Front, why would you bother?
I don't know. Obama already said that Assad must go, right?
Well, he did, but then he didn't do anything to help. So in terms of credibility, right now you see...
Well, now, come on, Mitchell. Isn't the Saudi operation an American operation there? Isn't the CIA coordinating all of that, like David Sanger says?
In my belief, they've paid some attention to it. They've backed some horses to see how they might do, and those horses didn't do very well. I think that one of the things that you need to recognize is that we're in a period now. I've been doing this for 10 years, starting with the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq. Is we started with this period where the U.S. was deeply involved in the Middle East and trying to make changes to governments as they saw fit based on an ideology built around what we call the neocon idea. And that didn't go well. Everyone recognizes that at this point. You know, the U.S. involvement in the Middle East has been a disaster now for a decade. And as a result, they're trying to find a new way. And one of them is hands off. The simple fact is, yes, America would like to see Assad fall, but they're not really willing to be the ones that put al-Qaeda in power. And that's something that they're very afraid of. We always joke about how, you know, well, didn't you sort of start the Taliban in Afghanistan? Well, you know, when you backed the Afghans against the Soviets, and if you talk to a CIA guy, he'll tell you, yeah, that's what happened. We're not going to do that again. You know, so to a certain extent, this is the American government learning some lessons about the limit of their power. And one of them is, if you're looking at al-Qaeda trying to overthrow Bashar Assad and you don't like either, why not just see what plays out and deal with it then? You don't want to necessarily get involved in a knife fight that ugly with this many ugly guys involved.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, I mean, they've already done enough to help in the first place, so it's not quite hands-off, but I understand what you're saying. And believe
well,
me, I prefer
on,
this to doubling down.
But in terms of serious stuff, it has. Look, they've given some radios. You know, they've given some body armor, they gave some humanitarian stuff, and they trained like 70 guys and armed them from Jordan that we know about. And these 70 guys went into Syria and probably disappeared. They joined other factions, or who knows, they could be running like falafel shops for all we know. But they just, it just never really took. When that started happening, you saw the American government go, wait a second. You know, who are these people? And the problem that everybody faces is we've never seen groups like Nusra, Arar al-Sham, and even to a certain extent the Islamic Front before. These guys definitely subscribe to an ideology that on paper, you know, the West is uncomfortable with, but at the same time, they've been relatively focused and haven't been nearly as insane as we've seen, you know, former al-Qaeda-linked groups doing mass kidnappings and beheadings and, you know, random car bombings. You know, most of that stuff in Syria has been done by ISIS. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, I'm not saying they haven't done any of it. They've done some.
Yeah, I mean,
so
these are the same guys hoisting the black
guys
flag over Fallujah right now, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, they're not. That's ISIS. That's not Nusra.
Right.
Although I'm sure Nusra guys in a normal situation would be perfectly happy to go fight in Fallujah against the Shiite government in Maliki. They're doing it in Syria right now. I mean, so again, the difference is small. But no, you don't see them doing that. They're fighting against those guys because they want a revolution for the Syrians. As a result, now we're seeing a lot of confusion on the ground, and new groups are forming. One of them is the Islamic Front. Frankly, I think they're ready to work with the Americans, and I think it would be smart to explore if it's possible, because they are the largest, they've been fairly responsible, their guys are reasonably well organized and trained, and they have a command and control that we've never seen before. If they tell a unit to do something, the unit's going to do it. Now that you've established that, you go negotiate with the guy who can give the orders. Whether or not those negotiations would go anywhere, I don't know. But I do think for the American government, it would be smart to have a meeting with those guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a piece of foreign policy where they tried.
Why would you talk to the Americans? They haven't helped you yet. Why should they get a vote? That's what all the Syrians tell me is, why does Obama get to decide who stays and who goes and what type of rebellion we should have? He doesn't give us any money. He doesn't give us any weapons. He doesn't give us any help. If you want a say in what's going on in Syria, become involved in Syria. So there's a disconnect there. Half of America thinks we're too involved in Syria, and the Syrians think we don't get an opinion because they don't see anything from us.
Mm. Well, it's funny, though, the way anyone looking critically at this could have told you that, you know, it was jihadists doing suicide bombings from the very beginning of the uprising in Syria.
Well,
and there were reports of Libyan fighters going there right away. And there were, you know, Hillary Clinton said at the time that, hey, you know, I'm an al-Zawahiri and Hamas are backing this uprising. So I'm not so sure, even though we don't like Assad, I'm not so sure we want to back his enemies here. And then it was months later, according to her and her friends' leaks in the New York Times, that she and Petraeus and Panetta tried to get Obama to do just that and to double down on it, and that he refused to go along with their plan. But she seemed to express that they knew good and well that the opposition here are you know, no Thomas Jeffersons, as Colin Powell would say.
No, but the thing is, you're just simply never going to find any Thomas Jeffersons in the Middle East. It's their own culture and it's their own world. They're going to come up with the people that they come up with.
Right.
And it's not going to look like what we do. So, you know, on some level, that's what you have to recognize. If you want to see Bashar gone and you want to have influence with the rebels that took him over, you might have to back somebody who's not entirely somebody you would normally do business with.
Yeah.
But these are decisions that are brutal that the President of the United States has to make, because I can make a strong argument as a journalist who covers it for either course of action.
Well, I set up a straw man about the Jefferson thing. I mean,
one way or another.
You could at least, you got to find somebody who hasn't sworn allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, right? I mean, is that too much to ask?
Well, that's exactly part of it. Hold on. No, that's exactly part of what we're discovering now. And even so, it's something that we're trying to figure out. What does that mean exactly? So here you've got a group that says they're al-Qaeda, that Zawahiri says, these guys aren't mine, and I wish they would stop. Then you've got a group that's being a reasonably responsible actor on the ground who says, where's Zarqawi's guys? And he likes them. Then there's another group. He has people who are definitely supportive of a lot of al-Qaeda's agenda who haven't expressed any interest in international jihad and just say, we're conservative farm boys who want to overthrow the regime.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the problem is we had a really easy time early on in this, you know, so-called war on terror that got handed to us back in 2001. You know, in terms of determining who were bad guys and who weren't. The problem is there's no such thing as complete bad guys and complete good guys, or they're very, very rare. And determining who is useful and what the cost is what we've done a terrible job of for 10 years. Right now, I see the administration basically abandoning Syria because they can't really tell what will be the good move, and I suppose that's better than them doing something stupid.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael Hayden says it's time to go ahead and switch back to Assad, the former head of the CIA.
Well, you know, and there's a big push for that. There's a big push for that. In fact, I'm increasingly convinced a Western PR company is working with Assad, because the way he's gotten on message in the last 9 months or so is astounding. Like, he speaks like George Bush. So does Hassan Nasrallah. Like, when you hear these guys give speeches now, I covered 2001, 2002 period. I covered the coverage of the passage of the Patriot Act. And these guys are using the exact same garbage rhetoric that we saw from lawmakers back then that allowed us to get stuff like the Patriot Act and the invasion of Iraq without actually thinking about what we were going to do when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are making all the same mistakes.
Let me ask you this real quick, Mitchell. How many Western Europeans do you think, I mean, just very vague ballpark numbers, do you think have traveled to Syria to fight with the rebels here? Tens, hundreds?
Ballpark figure based on, I've heard a range of different figures. Western Europeans, give it 1,000 at the high end, definitely more than 500.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm a little low. When you start getting into Eastern Europeans, Bosnians, Chechens, Dagestan, stuff like that, those guys have come in about the same numbers. There's got to be at least 1,000 of those guys.
Right. So that's, you know, looking.
And you start mixing in various dudes from all over the place. You know, a dude from America, three guys from Canada. I think a Canadian guy died today for ISIS. You know, a handful, but the big bulk has come from the Caucasus in Eastern Europe and from Western Europe, you know, families of second-generation immigrants, stuff like that.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned Afghanistan, and it seems like that could be a terrible precedent here for the blowback coming in the future from this battleground, which is, what, 1,500 miles west of Afghanistan, after all, right on the Mediterranean.
Right.
So, anyway,
I gotta tell you,
sorry,
American policy.
Go ahead.
American policy towards this stuff often resembles a bunch of guys who just don't want to be responsible for that in 5 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they'll be gone by then, but we won't. All right. Thanks very much. I sure appreciate your time on the show, Mitchell. Very much.
No problem. Always a pleasure. Bye.
All right, everybody. That is Mitchell Prothero reporting from Lebanon for McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. We'll be back with Doug Casey in a minute. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Kotowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Looks like Glenn Greenwald was talking about his brand new book, Nowhere to Hide, coming out on CNN there on mute in the background. That's good news. Always like a good Greenwald book. All right, and that was Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy, D.C. He's been doing great work on the Syrian war. I highly suggest you keep up with his work. Sign up for their morning email. That'll keep you up to date. And next up is Doug Casey, zillionaire, anarchist, investor, author, keeper of the website internationalman.com. Doug Casey's International Man is the site. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Doug? It's been years and years, actually.
Great, Scott. It's nice to talk to you. I'm currently, in, as you know, in Punta del Este, Uruguay. So we have a pretty clear connection, though, nonetheless.
Yeah, well, you must be at a high elevation because we seem to have a clear line of sight to you there. All right, well, good. So I appreciate
actually,
you joining
us. Actually, I'm not. I'm at the beach. Uruguay is a quiet, backward little country. And what happens is people from Argentina mainly, and I mainly live in Argentina, come over here for the summer season to go to the beach, and that's what I'm doing here.
I see. Well, nothing wrong with that. Certainly couldn't complain. All right. Well, so I'm very happy to have you on the show. From time to time, people say, man, you ought to get Doug Casey on, and I always agree with them, but then for some reason I hadn't gotten around to it in a while, so... it'd be good to pick your brain a little bit about what's going on. First of all, well, we just had this conversation with this reporter about the civil war in Syria, where America's clearly been taking the Saudi-Sunni side against the Iranian Shiite axis or whatever. But on the other hand, we have the possibility, it looks like, of a real warming and opening up of America's relationship with Iran. And by that, I mean... The main outstanding issue is this bogus controversy over their nuclear program, which Obama seems to be trying pretty hard to negotiate an end to. And then that, I wonder whether you think that that could be the start, whether you anticipate, you know, maybe something positive in the Middle East for a change and an end of the American-Iranian Cold War. What do you think about that?
Well, I always hope for the best, but unfortunately... it's the nature of the state, it's the nature of government to get into conflicts and wars. I mean, these things have been going on for 5,000 years of recorded history. So that especially when things get tough domestically, the government looks for somebody else to blame, some foreigner to unite the people. So I'd say the odds of things getting better with Iran are low, actually. All we really know is what we read in the paper and hear on the news. And I really read the paper for entertainment, not for information. The main thing that the U.S. has going for it at this point is a gigantic military. And when you have, when all you have is a gold-plated hammer, which is what I equate the military to, everything starts looking like a nail. So the chances are good they're going to use it. So I'm hoping for the best, but I'm not expecting the best.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought you'd say, and I pretty much feel the same way, but I don't know. I was looking at the fight in the Senate and where the president seemed to really be leaning on the congressman for a change, which he doesn't usually do that on anything, and he seemed to really be telling them to back off these sanctions and let him do his thing without screwing it up. And it seemed to have worked. And so I don't know if that means he really wants to get the final deal done, but at least it means he doesn't want them screwing it up right now, and that's kind of something.
Well, you know, my view on that is that the U.S. government is sticking its nose into absolutely everybody's business, everybody else's business. We've got combat troops in 100 countries around the world, and the natives don't appreciate it. So if Obama or any other president wanted to do something for the good of the American people, he'd withdraw all of the military personnel that the U.S. has all around the world. Not only would it keep us out of trouble and make us less enemies, but it would forestall the impending bankruptcy of the U.S. government, because the security establishment and the military probably cost about $1 trillion per year, and we get very, very little return on that malinvestment.
Well, but you know, I guess it is the war party, but others repeat it too, like they believe it, that, you know, all this militarism, yeah, it's big, but as a percentage of GDP, it's really not that big of a deal, not when you compare it to Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security or whatever it is, and so don't worry about it. Really, you know, like Bill Kristol would say, get over it, let's have some more wars.
Well, he's a complete fool, of course, and it's true, in a perhaps a $16 trillion economy, $1 trillion of pure waste doesn't look that bad. But my view is that not only should the military be cut down probably about 90%, because, of course, the U.S. spends as much on its military and security, so-called, as every other country in the world put together does. But Medicaid and Medicare should be abolished. And I've got to say that that should happen to Social Security, too, although, unfortunately, there are now tens of millions of people that have been defrauded into relying on it. So I don't know how you handle that program. I guess the next generation is just going to have to be turned into limited serfs to pay for that obligation. But very little that the U.S. government does these days serves a useful purpose.
Yeah. Well, that was the Ron Paul trade-off in his presidential campaign, right? Was, even though he is a hardcore libertarian, how about we just abolish the empire completely, and then we use those savings to shore up Social Security for the people who desperately need it? That seems like a pretty fair compromise, right?
Well, I suppose, under the circumstances, you have to do something, because you've got tens of millions of people that have been induced fraudulently to rely on this giant Ponzi scheme called Social Security. So the U.S. government's gotten itself, it's just one more pickle that the U.S. government's gotten itself into. So I suppose, but there's so much more that needs to be done to slow the descent of the empire at this point. I mean, the U.S. dollar is in a state of collapse. It's rotten to the core. All of the regulations and so forth that the U.S. government has and puts on more every day is stultifying economic growth. It's very problematical. I question whether things could be turned around. Even if Ron Paul had been elected, I don't think it would have gotten us anywhere, because I suspect the first thing that would have happened would that he would have been that he would have been visited by the heads of all of our Praetorian agencies, like the NSA and the CIA and the FBI and the rest of them, and of course a bunch of generals and admirals. And he would have had a severe talking to, telling him that he simply can't change these things and these guys have all the guns. And even then, the Congress would have impeached him. And if that hadn't worked, the average American would have turned out into the streets to riot because he thinks that the government is a magic cornucopia. So I actually think that the situation is beyond redemption at this point.
Yeah. Well, and you seem to be saying that the empire's coming down one way or the other at this point, too. It doesn't. How much longer can it last if we don't roll it back deliberately, do you think?
Well, look, you're fighting against the second law of thermodynamics. And what that holds is that entropy overcomes everything. All systems wind down. And that's what's happening politically as well. The larger and the more complex a structure becomes, the more energy inputs it takes to maintain it. And that's really where we are with the U.S. government at this point. I don't see them taking it apart slowly. I think what we're going to have to wait for is for it all to collapse at once.
All right, we'll be right back, everybody, with more with Doug Casey from theinternationalman.com after this. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on the Liberty Express and scotthorton.org. And we're talking with Doug Casey, zillionaire, anarchist, investor, author, writer, world traveler. And we're talking about the bankruptcy of the empire. And you know what? Let me ask you, Doug, because as an economist, I'm basically good at foreign policy, you know, armchair economist at best. I like good economists, but I don't really read their books. But so what I do know is my whole life, I've been hearing that there's way too much national debt. In the Reagan years, that Reagan and the Democrats, they left us with a $4 trillion debt. The collapse of our society is imminent. And I've heard that this whole time. And I wonder whether, hey, aren't these guys the brilliant scientists they claim to be, and we've had some pretty severe corrections from time to time, but it doesn't seem like the dollar itself is falling apart, and can't they just keep printing money forever or what? It seems like they can.
Well, that's a very good question, Scott. As far as the debt is concerned, let's take a look at the concept of debt. When you have debt, it means that you're taking earnings from the future and mortgaging them so you can spend them now, or you're borrowing capital that others have saved in the past and using it now. So debt is a sign that you're living above your means, at least consumer debt. And most of the debt we have is for consumption as opposed to used to create new wealth. Savings, on the other hand, means that you've been producing more than you're consuming, and that difference is savings. Now, it's really very simple. Savings is good, debt is bad, and there's no way around that. I don't think there's any arguing with it, because debt shows that you've been consuming more than you've been producing. The problem is this, is that the productive people in the U.S. and the world are basically saving in currency. They're saving in dollars. But unfortunately, the dollar is a floating abstraction. It's not backed by anything. It doesn't represent anything. It's basically an IOU nothing on the part of the U.S. government, which itself is bankrupt. So the real problem that we have is that the savers, who are the ones that are producing more than they're consuming, are exactly the ones that are going to be penalized in the future because they're saving in dollars. So what's going to happen to the value of the dollar? It's going to reach its intrinsic value, which is essentially nothing. So we're looking at a real financial and economic and also social catastrophe from a number of points of view.
All right, so at one point, are you talking about there will be a crack-up boom where just everyone realizes that the dollar is just as fake as you realize it is, and no one will expect that they'll be able to trade with them tomorrow, and that'll just be the end of that on, you know, Black Tuesday coming up one day? Or how's that work?
Well, it's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen, but right now, the U.S. government, through the Fed, buying debt in the market is creating about 80 billion new dollars every month. This is a huge amount of paper. Now, most of it's just sitting in the banks right now. Most of it isn't going out into society to bid for goods and services. Some of it is, and prices are rising gradually across the board. But will we have a crack-up boom? Well, if all that money exits from the institutions where it's sitting and goes out and starts buying stuff, yeah, it could be a phony boom, the kind of thing that happened in Germany in 1922. Mm-hmm. But there's actually even more to it than that, and it's worse than that, because the main export of the U.S. for a couple of decades has been dollars. And right now there are, we don't know exactly, but there's probably about 8 trillion U.S. dollars that are outside the U.S. And unlike Americans who have to use dollars by law to settle accounts, foreigners don't have to. They only use dollars because they're liquid and convenient. And at some point, when the dollar, which rests on nothing other than confidence, when that confidence goes away, the foreigners are going to dump their dollars. And at that point, they're all going to come back to the U.S. Inflation's been relatively low in the U.S. because we've been exporting those dollars abroad and importing Mercedes and Sonys and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we've had less purchasing media and more goods. But at some point, when the confidence vanishes on the part of foreigners, the dollars are going to come back and the titles to land and companies and real goods are going to go out of the U.S. So that could be rather catastrophic.
Hmm. All right, but now all the Democrats in D.C. say that no, because they're experts and they know what they're doing. And so, and that you're looking at it, it sounds perhaps like you're oversimplifying it. And in truth, no, we can keep making the Chinese make stuff for us for real cheap and we don't have to work. And it's all, you know, you call it debt that will be, you know, saddled on the backs of coming generations. They call it a bookkeeping trick. That means that they can get away with it. It has nothing to do with saddling anybody with anything. Don't worry about it, they say.
Yeah, no, that's true. I guess you really can get a free lunch. You really can get something for nothing in the world. At least that's been the case so far. But it's very problematical what's happening here in the U.S. I mean, governments, just the institution of government, it's coercive, it's stupid. And essentially, although I know most people don't see it this way, it really serves no useful purpose. There's nothing that the government can make that the market would not and could not and should not make. But the big problem is that the whole world relies on the U.S. and its currency. The whole world owns the debt of the U.S. government, although the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. owns more and more of it. So when things blow up here in the U.S., it's much more serious than when things blow up in Argentina or Zimbabwe,
right,
or France, which is the next place in Europe that I think we're going to have a crisis. But it's not just in the U.S. There are other big economies. I mean, the Japanese economy is a gigantic accident waiting to happen at this point. The same is true of China. They're inflating their the yuan even faster than we're inflating the dollar. I wouldn't touch a yuan at this point. And in Europe, in another couple of generations, the Europeans are mainly going to be a source of houseboys and maids for the Chinese after the Chinese recover from the financial catastrophe that they're facing. In other words, we're going through a real period of turmoil, I think, over the next decade. And I don't know exactly how it's going to come out, but it's going to be most interesting to watch it unfold.
All right, now, real quick, I've got this theory that Ron Paul finally got through to Ben Bernanke a little bit after all those years of hectoring him, and that he came up with, and you named the scam earlier, where he creates all this new money to make all the banks whole on all their bad bets, but then he pays them to keep the money at the Fed and not loan it out. And after all, the economy sucks, so there's no good bets out there in the economy to loan the money out for. So the fractional reserve rate is not kicking in, and that widespread inflation is not kicking in. So wouldn't we have to have a real recovery of some kind to set the domino, to knock the dominoes over and cause that terrible inflation that you're fearing? And hadn't Bernanke sort of headed that off by making sure that we all stay unemployed and that all the pressure on prices stays low for that reason?
Well, you may be giving him more credit for understanding something about the economy than he deserves. I give Bernanke credit for being extremely lucky, because he's gone from being an academic, a college professor, to having been one of the most powerful men in the world, and now he's escaped before the collapse. So he's going to get his personal payoff, which is probably going to be about $50 million in book contracts, corporate directorships, consulting fees, speaking engagements. So Ben Bernanke is going to be just fine for the rest of his life. I pity that poor fool Janet Yellen, who's picked up from him. But no, it's going to be tough times any way that you cut it. I really don't see any way out of it. Put it this way, Scott. If we entered a gigantic financial hurricane in 2007 and we went through the leading edge of it in 2008 and 2009, now, for the last few years, we've been in the eye of the storm. And it's a big eye because it's a big storm. Mm-hmm. But I think this year we're going to go out to the trailing edge of the hurricane, and it's going to be much more severe and much longer lasting than the leading edge that we experienced in 2008 and 2009.
You're as scary as a local cop. Make me want to flee, pack up my meager possessions, and flee to Uruguay.
Well,
I think there's a lot of people in the audience saying, me too, man, right now.
Well, this is a quiet and backward but peaceful little country. I usually prefer to be across the Plate River in Argentina, which is a lot more fun, but it's summertime down here, so I'm doing what most of the Argentines who are in a position to do so can do.
All right, well, it's great to talk to you again. I sure appreciate you joining us on the show today, Doug.
Well, thanks, Scott. It was a pleasure being here with you.
All right, everybody. That is Doug Casey.
Some friends for an asado.
I'm sorry, I accidentally hit the button on you. Say again?
And now I'm going off to join some friends for an asado. But
Very good. Well, have a great day. I sure appreciate your time.
Okay, talk to you later.
All right. Everybody, that is Doug Casey, zillionaire, anarchist, author, and inventor, and prognosticator, and very interesting man, internationalman.com.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. This is the show. I like being a radio show. It's fun. I like Doug Casey, man. That guy's all right. You want to see some good speeches, look him up on YouTube. All right, so now we go to our friend Marcy Wheeler. Empty Wheel, she's called on the blogosphere and on Twitter. That's emptywheel.net. Welcome back to the show. Marcy, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. So
glad to be here.
So today was the big day of Obama's big speech on Fox News, which is the channel I happen to watch the speech on. At the end, all the experts said, well, this won't please anybody. All the critics are going to be mad as hell, and all the people who are sticking up for the NSA are going to be mad, too, that its powers are going to be pushed back this much, something like that. Is that about your estimation of this or no?
No, both James Clapper and Dianne Feinstein and Mike Rogers have issued statements which are basically giant victory laps. Also, you know, sort of saying, oh, he chose moderation, but they're so happy. It's pretty clear they didn't choose moderation. He basically just did nothing, did almost nothing to change what is in place right now.
Wow. Okay, so now I saw you wrote on Twitter that, you know, at the very least here, he hasn't proposed any legislative changes at all. There's no real concession. If anything, he wants to tweak some rules. He wants to tweak some rules, or he doesn't even really want to tweak some rules. What's the deal?
He said that Congress should figure out what to do with the dragnet, so the phone records of somewhere between all or a substantial number of Americans. That was going to happen anyway, because the Patriot Act expires in June of 2015, and in advance of that, Congress was going to have a debate about what to do with the dragnet. So that's going to happen in any case. So that's not a change. It's just PR. The other thing he said Congress should figure out how to do is the advocate in the FISA court. And so, you know, we'll see whether anything happens there. I think everyone at least gives lip service to approving that, except for the FISA court has now weighed in saying they can't have any oversight, because if they do, then the White House will have to start writing down all their requests, and that might lead them to be less forthcoming. It's just crazy. It might lead them to be less forthcoming. So, well, you know, that's the only other thing that Obama asked to have Congress do. And on a couple of key purported changes, just as an example, he said, we won't let anybody do backdoor searches. This is, remember, the government gets huge chunks of data from Section 702 collection, meaning legal collection from Google and other internet companies. And right now the government says we can go into that collected information and search for Americans without even having a reasonable articulable suspicion. We don't need any suspicion to go see what Americans show up in that database. And Obama's proposal is, well, I'm going to have the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General make it so that we no longer do that for criminal cases. He didn't even say criminal investigation, which means they can still use it to recruit informants and what have you. But that's not enforceable. I mean, it's going to be secret. It's going to be more minimization procedures that won't get shared with the public. And so, and moreover, his Solicitor General had already said you need to start announcing this stuff in court, and DOJ is already panicking about that. So they were already going to stop doing that because they were having to do this you know, they were going to have to start announcing it. And as soon as it becomes clear to Americans how much of this backdoor searching is going to go on, we're all going to flip out. So mm-hmm. he didn't really change it. He just, you know, he just gave an excuse so that we all go, oh, good, great, and change, when it's not really a change. It's not enforceable. We can't see it. And so, and it's not going to be a legal change. You know, this is one of the most, I'm sorry, I'm so excited about this. I mean, so up in arms about this, but this is one of the most egregious problems from a Fourth Amendment perspective of all of this dragnet. And because they're getting content, you know, they keep saying, we're not getting content, we're not getting content. Well, yeah, they are. They say they don't even need suspicion to go in and get this content. And they're not really changing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now, so this to me is, I guess, sticks out to me as the most important part of this NSA thing. Because even if they are spying on us all day, and they're the military, and they claim it's incidental to their counterterrorism mission, blah, blah, whatever, as horrible as that is, and it's absolutely as horrible can be, but if they're just turning over all of their haul to whatever state and local and federal civilian law enforcement and regulatory agencies for them to sift through on fishing expeditions looking for anyone to be regulated on anything or anyone who's behind on any tax or whatever it is, that is the essence of the possible totalitarian nightmare contained in all this, far beyond the metadata from our telephones and that kind of thing, if you ask me. And so it sounds like what you're saying Obama said today is, yeah, you're right, that's a problem. That's why we're going to codify it into the procedures even more than it already is and do it some more, because that's what we're about. Is that pretty much what happened today?
I don't think they're going to do it anymore, but they're going to continue doing most of what they're doing anyway. And, you know, like, there are four other reasons that they go in and do backdoor searches on this stuff. One of them probably is when they identify a call from the contact chaining, they go in and check the actual conversations because they have them and find out whether they're interesting. And if they're interesting, then they use that to go ahead and get a FISA warrant against the Americans. So, you know, all of those uses, Obama is not swearing off. Hmm. They're still in place.
You're saying they do have the audio content to go back and check anything that they find interesting in the 702 data. Is that it?
Yeah. Or internet content. So, you know, that's what they'll go get from Google, for example.
Well, but wait, this is the part that I've been, I guess, most confused about this whole time, was whether or not, because it seems like I had thought Glenn Greenwald had said as much that they don't have the audio, but they do have everything but the audio. But you're telling me they do, they're collecting the audio of all the phone calls to go back and check?
They're going to have a lot of the audio, because a lot of the audio they're collecting in bulk. They're collecting at the switches. Uh-huh. And so, you know, for a place with a lot of terrorism, say Somalia, where we don't speak the language, we have five translators, they're going to collect a ton of the content for a bit of time, and then use the metadata that they're also collecting and to find out whether any of that content is interesting. Mm-hmm. And if none of it's interesting, they probably get rid of it and free up that storage space. But yeah, and remember, most internet content doesn't disappear right away. I mean, most internet content the Googles of the world can get to, and so that doesn't disappear. So yeah, they have ways of either, and frankly, you know, James Clapper pretty much said this within the first 2 weeks of the Snowden leaks. He said, we use metadata as a Dewey Decimal System to go in and figure out what to pull off the shelves. Well, that assumes they've got the content on the shelves somewhere.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like it. After all, this telephone conversation over plain old telephone technology will just be an MP3 file for history's sake at scotthorton.org/interviews, you know, and I'm sure they've got you know, the right codec where they could shrink down a conversation like this to a pinprick on the database, right?
Yeah.
That's nothing. Even a half-hour conversation.
Yeah.
So there you go. I mean, the quality of the human voice, they could reduce the quality way down and still be able to tell everything that you say, and then zip that down by whatever equation and make it a much smaller file. I mean, MP3 came out in 1993 or something, right? So... I'm sure they got a lot better ways to save space on saving those files now. All right. Mm-hmm. And now, so how much of the Snowden documents have we seen about them actually saving the audio of all the telephone conversations?
We have, I mean, he actually said at one point, again, pretty early on, he's like, they don't need to necessarily grab the content. They grab the metadata to figure out what they're going to go grab later.
So, oh, okay. So you know, from now on, grab the audio, not go back and look at.
Right. But more of what we do is internet content, right?
Right.
And we learned yesterday that they're collecting how many billions of text messages a day. I mean, a lot of our quote unquote phone conversations these days, especially overseas, take place via text, and that's easier to capture, and they're capturing it.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so the Republicans and the Democrats and whoever say that, yeah, but, you know, Obama, he's got to read that morning brief about all the dangerous threats, and Marcy, she just doesn't understand about all the dangerous threats he's got to protect us from. And so maybe, like Robert Gates would say, you're looking at this thing as deeply as you are, through a soda straw, out of context, and you don't realize you're putting us all at risk, Marcy.
One of the interesting things about Obama's speech is he admitted in there that that the NSA basically engages in law enforcement for other countries. And that it makes sense at a level because we know that the NSA has been involved in the drug war, okay? So that's not surprising. We know that the administration has applied its terrorism approach to what it calls transnational crime organizations, including things like Yakuza, but also kind of more traditional mobs and real estate thus and so on. So Obama admitted that they're using this to pursue crime, to pursue law enforcement. But guess what? They're not going to use it to pursue the transnational criminal organization called JP Morgan Chase, which has done far more damage to this country than Mossadegh or the Yakuza or, you know, even many hacking groups that, you know, mob-connected hackers. And he even said, you know, we need to keep the hackers out of the stock market. We need to keep the hackers out of our bank account. I'm like, I'm a lot more worried about JP Morgan getting into any of those things than you know, Russian mob hackers, because JP Morgan has proven far more lethal than those hackers have. And until he starts, you know, that's one of the things that I find problematic with the example that you gave, which is, well, it's not, you know, you don't understand because you haven't seen the PDB. I've seen the damage that JP Morgan Chase has done around the country, and yet we're not pursuing them as a transnational crime organization as we would the Yakuza. So we do that, then I, you know, this is all just kind of smoke and mirrors. It's, you know, it's not, we're not going after the things that are the biggest risk to this country.
All right, we're talking with Marcy Wheeler. pardon me, kind of bit my tongue. Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, emptywheel.net, and Empty Wheel on Twitter as well, about the president's big speech. So, you know, I kept spacing out during that thing, but I was pretty sure he said nothing for 45 minutes, and I'm glad that you were able to pay attention and tell us what all he didn't say and what all he is leaving in place. But we'll be back with more on the NSA and the Snowden revelations with Marcy Wheeler right after this on The Scott Horton Show.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact, there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking Marcy Wheeler. Emptywheel.net is her great blog. She's got a couple co-authors there. Really great stuff, man. I'm telling you, you got to bookmark emptywheel.net, especially if you want to get to the bottom of all this NSA stuff. All right, and now, so, well, geez, I want to give you more or less the open floor to say what you want, because you understand this stuff so well, and I know, you know, you have your ideas about what kind of things might get people interested in or you know, even better, understand just how far this thing has gone, and you know, maybe we can even talk about what could be done about it.
Yeah, I just think I predicted weeks ago that Obama was going to use his review process to nod towards reform, but fundamentally to ensure that reform stays in the hands of the executive branch. And that played out. I mean, I nailed it. And the reason that's concerning is, in addition to his speech today, he released a presidential policy directive where he promised not to spy on people for political reasons and said he'd be nice to Europeans and yada, yada, yada. And at the very end of that, he said, you know, none of this limits my power. I'm not going to get the wording right, but none of this limits my power as commander-in-chief and yada, yada. And if people want changes, they can come to me under this process, and I'll consider the changes. And it's very similar to something George Bush did. I mean, to be able to spy on Americans who were not agents of a foreign power, John Yoo wrote a memo that basically said Executive Order 12333, which is what governs all foreign spying. Bush doesn't have to change the language of that, even if he doesn't abide by it. If he doesn't abide by the executive order, the written text of the executive order, we can all look at, it just means he has modified it. Doesn't have to change it. And Obama basically said today at the end of his presidential policy directive, I can change this anytime I want. And, you know, so I don't even know why we would consider it any more valuable than toilet paper, because it's just a PR process. You know, there's no reason we or the Europeans should believe anything he has in there, because he has signaled, I can change my mind at any time. And I reserve the right as commander-in-chief to keep changing my mind and doing whatever I want. And really, his ideal outcome, and Dianne Feinstein and Mike Rogers and James Clapper and all the people who are doing a victory lap right now, their ideal outcome is for us to believe things have changed and for them not to have changed. And I think, you know, I'm actually surprised by how little of a nod he made towards reform today.
Yeah, he's always much more concerned about right-wing critics than left ones. And also, well, he's kind of a conservative in the first place. But so this is, in other words, you're telling me it's kind of like he did with the with torture, saying, I ban torture. So instead of saying, I'm ordering the government to recognize the fact that the laws of America ban torture all along here and that they will obey those laws, instead, he was saying, it's as illegal as I say it is, and in essence, I reserve the right to change it back again. And of course, he's had the military handling people under Appendix M all this time, as we talked about on the show last week with Jeff Kay, right? So it's that same sort of thing where, never mind that the Fourth Amendment bans all this, he can just say, oh, well, I'm making this little change as long as I feel like it. It's really, well, that's part of having an empire, is having an emperor, I guess.
Well, and I love your example, because for two reasons in his speech. One is, in the middle of his speech, he said, well, and Bush, you know, we got a little out of control after 9/11 under Bush, including the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. And I was like, what? You know, because as soon as you call it enhanced interrogation techniques, it's a giant white flag to the deep state saying, I'm not going to do anything to rein in what you do. I'm going to call it by all the pretty euphemisms and let you continue doing what you do. And then he went on to say, one of the things he tried to do in his speech was pretend that he was about to make changes before that mean Edward Snowden came along and started leaking profusely. Uh-huh. And he said, you know, I had done this review and I had given this speech at the National Defense University, and I had said we were going to rein in the drone program, and I had said we were going to move away from the AUMF and move away from the war footage. And then that mean Edward Snowden started leaking profusely. I mean, those aren't the words he used, but that's effectively what he said. But the hysterical thing about that is, you know, He raised the drone program that he rolled out purported changes to, and since then, we continue to kill wedding parties, we continue to kill children, we continue to do it all under CIA, and we now know that they plan to continue doing it under CIA. So he pointed to something, I mean, twice in his speech, he pointed to things where he had backed off bringing the deep state, bringing the national security establishment under some kind of control, the torture and calling it enhanced interrogation techniques and drones, where nothing has changed in spite of his big PR push saying that it had changed. So there is zero reason why we should believe that spying is any different, because he signaled that he's not going to rein in the national security state.
Right. By the way,
I hope you didn't want good news for me, because I'm pretty...
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't expect good news. I just the truth, you know, which is what we're after here. Now, this third-party doctrine, am I right that that's just blatantly wrong, this court case, this Supreme Court case that says, well, if the phone company knows who you called, then clearly that's the same as surrendering that information to all of mankind, especially including the state, right? Huh? Where'd they come up with that?
Right, and he actually, in his speech, also said, oh, and these private companies are gathering more and more and more information, and golly, they're really bad. And I was like, if you believe that, and at the same time don't call for the end of the third-party doctrine today, then you're completely disingenuous. The logic being that, you know, and NSA apologists do this all the time. They're like, oh, my gosh, look at all that information your credit card company or Google collects on you. But the thing is, NSA or FBI can get every single bit of it, and they do. And so for them to say that it's bad to collect that information when they're collecting that same kind of information, when they're not preventing themselves from getting that information, is, you know, just the height of cynicism, because, you know, they're basically condemning their own actions but allowing themselves to continue it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shiny object.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, just think about it in the long term. If you took away all the parties and all the personalities, and you're just talking about, you know, this is going on in country X here, how long are we to expect that country to last, knowing that all this information is waiting around, that the NSA has access to, while children are being kidnapped, while people are being, you know, raped or held hostage or extorted by some terrible private villain out there, or maybe they are a defendant in a criminal case and they want to prove their alibi and whatever, and how long is it going to be, could it possibly be that you're going to have all this information that we swear we're collecting all this, but we're only querying it every once in a while, and maybe now they'll have to have extra permission than before or whatever, but how long before that just cracks open into a total flood and all government authorities across the land have access to the whole hall, you know?
Right. And I mean, it's just, it's frustrating.
Think about what that would be like.
Know.
You know, yeah. To have every deputy sheriff have access to your full file updated instantaneously at all times. Your kindergarten grades and everything since, you know? Your permanent record.
Your DNA.
Yeah.
So, one other thing people should know that Obama didn't mention, which again is pretty terrible news, he didn't mention NSA's weakening of encryption. Didn't even mention it. So we should assume that the NSA is going to continue to hoard 0 days, mm-hmm. which makes us all less secure. So that's more bad news. Sorry, people.
And I saw on your Twitter feed and on your blog, you talked about how he was using fancy jargon to kind of, weasel words around the topic of the NSA's role in cyber warfare, kind of disingenuously inserting it under the war on terror somehow or something. What did you mean by that? Or did I even get that right?
Wait, say that again.
About, you talked about how he was kind of using weasel words he ignored the NSA's role in cyber warfare. And he kind of skipped it, and then later he sort of added it in and snuck it in under the rubric of protecting us from the terrorists or something like that. And you're pointing out some hypocrisy there that I didn't quite catch on to.
Yeah, I mean, he basically said, oh, 9/11 happened, so we had to go after terrorists like this. And, oh, by the way, the biggest threats are cyber criminals. And it was a really interesting move because, A, he wanted to suggest the only spying that we do was collection of intelligence on our enemies at a time of war. And cyber is not that. Cyber is collection on, at best, the, you know, at biggest threat, the Chinese in time of peace. But it also is collection on American hackers domestically by a foreign intelligence agency, which shouldn't be going on. But that's sort of, you know, I think we're getting closer and closer to where they'll actually admit that. But it's also, you know, it's just really useful to watch what everybody from the administration does in their discussion of cyber, because it increasingly is the prime focus of this. And it increasingly means that this quote-unquote foreign intelligence collection is actually domestic intelligence collection, right, conducted for a variety of reasons. And they try not to admit that because that would make it another big problem. But that's really what's going on.
Right. Yeah, in other words, it's just the same old scam. Start off every sentence with Osama bin Laden and end it with some more rights you got to give up, right?
Exactly.
Some more policies that have got to be implemented. Oh, man. All right, now, okay, here's a crazy conspiracy theory, and you have hardly any time to tell me what you think about it all. But it seems to me like it's the New York Times and the Post and those guys who are breaking the Snowden stories about what our government has on other governments. And I was wondering if you think maybe that's sort of a limited hangout meant to, you know, spin the whole thing. That I thought I liked this Snowden guy, but he's narking on stuff that he shouldn't be telling. Where Greenwald is really seems to be sticking more to the domestic abuse stuff. Am I going off half-cocked there, you think?
I don't know. I do know that Greenwald for a while was trying to, I think, demonstrate the degree to which, you know, the U.S. is this big dragnet, and really the U.S. empire is this big dragnet, which is slightly different from what Sanger at the New York Times just revealed. But one of the things that got missed in that the recent Sanger story that talked about the jump the gap hack that the NSA can do. Mm-hmm. Sanger said that he had that story from his Iran reporting. We used that for Stuxnet. He knew about it, and he withheld the story. And so for a lot of people to respond to it, to say, oh my God, Edward Snowden's making us less safe, the Iranians already knew about it. If the Iranians knew about it, tell me the Chinese and the Russians don't know about it. They do. And so all it is yet another case where things don't get reported in the United States that our adversaries already know. And the people that are, you know, the people, the secrets are being kept from are not our adversaries, but actually you and me. Because if we found out, then, you know, we'll be angry.
Yeah, exactly. Although, I wonder why they even care about that anymore, but that's another show. Thanks very much for your time, Marcy. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, take care and have a good weekend.
You too. All right, everybody. All right, and that's the show. Overtime. We're all done. See you Sunday morning on KPFK. Or back here Monday, 3 to 5 on Eastern Time on Liberty Express.